Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sunny Bunch, culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'm pleased to be joined today, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post, Peter Suderman of Reason. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
We're swell.
I'm really happy to be talking about movies with friends in person.
In person. Programming note, I do not have my laptop because it broke, because the keyboard keys popped off. So you're going to have to deal with me kind of stumbling through this episode. I do not have a script. But we're going to make it work. We're going to make it work because we're here in person. We're doing it live, people. We're doing it live. First up, in controversies and non-troversies, is Wes Anderson a fascist? Go, Alyssa. No, this is, we were trying to figure out what to do for cons and nons this week, and luckily for us, an academic out in Twitter land decided to talk about how much she hated The French Dispatch because it is just the ultimate representation of Wes Anderson's fascioid tendencies. That was a new word for me. I had not heard the phrase fascioid before, but it's a good one here. So I just want to read the tweet that sparked all this. This is from Sophie Lewis. Watch The French Dispatch. It convinced me Wes Anderson has crossed over decisively from what was previously possible to condone as, quote, a political world of winking whiteness and poignant quirkiness, end quote, into a fascioid trivializing of struggle and active investment in the carceral state. And the thing I like most about this tweet is how delightfully insane it is, first of all.
It's so insane. It's so insane.
It's delightfully insane, but it is also indicative of like a certain type of very bad discourse online, which is the thing where an academic watches a movie and has the most ridiculous response possible to it, and everybody takes turns dunking on them until people get indignant and they're like, well, what are you saying? Are you saying movies aren't political? Well, of course they're political, you know? And it really, the whole thing gets to a real problem, but also kind of source of entertainment, frankly, when it comes to discussing movies online. Alyssa, serious question. How have we managed to avoid sounding so insane these years?
Despite
having many terrible movie takes and many, many wacky, crazy opinions, such as, for instance, e.g., Alderaan had it coming. That's a classic for me. Like, how do we manage to stop from seeming so freaking insane?
We're just better than everyone else. I mean, obviously.
Speak for yourself.
At least some of us.
I'm just better than everyone else. No, I think that I found this take fascinating. And maybe it's because I don't know what it means to be fascioid.
Fascioid.
I think it's just a cool way to say fascist.
I want a t-shirt in the Wes Anderson font that just says fascioid. Fascioid period on the front of it. You know, Futura Bold or some such.
Okay, that's maybe we can get that for you for Christmas, Sunny. But no, what I found fascinating about this is that Wes Anderson is interested in institutions, right? I mean, you know, Rushmore is all about Max Fisher's relationship to his school and the various sort of clubs and institutions that he builds up. You know, Moonrise Kingdom is in part about, you know, the Khaki Scouts. It's about the, you know, local police force in this tiny island in Maine. You know, The French Dispatch is about a magazine, but you know, in none of these films is Anderson sort of arguing that all human activity should be subsumed into the institution, right? Which is sort of what I assume people who, you know, talk about fascism mean broadly. And often Anderson's movies are very sympathetic to people and to individuals who fail to fit into institutions. He is sympathetic to and interested in rebellion a lot of the time, or at minimum interested in kind of quirkiness and failure to conform. And so the idea of him as fascioid just makes – or fascist – does
please
not
use the preferred nomenclature, fascioid. That is, we're not talking about fascism here. We're talking about fascioidism.
And so just the idea that Wes Anderson is like enamored of a state apparatus and thinks that all human activity should be sort of subsumed to the glory of that apparatus is just inexplicable to me. And look, I'm someone who is sympathetic to the idea that the author at some level sort of cedes control of their work and that people can see things in work that artists didn't necessarily intend or weren't necessarily aware or was there. But this just seems crazy pants to me. It would make more sense to me if this tweeter was a bot who existed to just generate insane film takes, because I am having such a hard time coming up with a plausible reading of the French Dispatch in particular, and of Anderson's Over It in general, that lends itself to that reading in any sensible material way.
So I think that the key to understanding this take, which is very bad and wrong, but I think the key to understanding it is the end of the tweet, which is that it is moving into a fascioid trivializing of struggle and active investment in the carceral state. And she seems to be reading the French Dispatch as a kind of defense of putting a lot of people in prison because that's awesome, which is a bizarre, bizarre reading for a movie that is about individual freedom and, like, the beauty of art and the ways that it frees us and the ways that, like, that individual difference and creation make life worth living. And like, this is a movie that's like, that isn't like, hey man, prison's pretty good. It's like, but that seems to be what she took from this.
Well, and also, I mean, the French Dispatch in particular, Moonrise Kingdom to a lesser extent, the Royal Tenenbaums are all movies that are about, and The Fantastic Mr. Fox certainly are all movies about the idea that just because sometimes struggle is ridiculous or adorable doesn't make it any less moving, right? I mean, The French Dispatch
in particular. Yeah, she objects to the idea that it's cute.
Right, but part of what Anderson is saying, like the, you know, the student rebellion section of The French Dispatch, for example, is both based in a real conflict over boys' access to the girls' dormitories that was part of, you know, sort of one of the kind of pre-incidents to the French student rebellions in 1968. But it's also, you know, it's a story about being young, and young people are sometimes absurd, but that doesn't mean that the process of growing up and rebelling against institutions is not meaningful or even successful. It's just that sometimes the struggle is silly or sweet, and that makes it more human. I think it actually makes it more sympathetic. But, you know, this reads like a tweet by someone who still takes their Che Guevara t-shirt seriously, and it's just, it's bad as politics, it's bad as film criticism, it's just so embarrassing.
Well, one thing I think should be discussed here is whether or not fashoid is just a synonym for bad. I mean, is this just a situation where, like, everything I don't like is fascist? Everything I don't like is, you know,
possibly
the everything I don't like is Hitler situation.
Well, and in particular, I mean, I think that is more plausible given the sort of complaining about Wes Anderson's whiteness. And look, his movies are set in, like, highly specific white milieus. Although, again, like, having The French Dispatch be sort of the, like, the supposed reifying incident in the whiteness of Wes Anderson's Over It is particularly weird considering, you know, the third segment of it, which is, you know, in part about the meeting of a black queer man and an Asian, you know, exemplar of French cooking, sort of finding communion in their differentness. And the idea that a movie that includes that is supposed to reify Wes Anderson's whiteness, I mean, okay. Like,
so I think it's not quite a synonym for I don't like this. I do think it's a synonym for I think the politics of Wes Anderson and Wes Anderson's movies are bad. Because if you look at the follow-up tweet that she sent, it's actually, I feel like there are moments where conservative doesn't even fully cover it. It kind of feels more evil than that sometimes. You know what I mean?
I don't.
More evil. That's evil. In her, it's her, that she uses an acronym for, you know what I mean? But like, that's what her tweet says, is that it's beyond conservative. It's moving actively into evil because I guess conservative is like the step before evil in her mind. And
well,
so
it's a sliding scale.
Right.
We need Elon Musk to get like one of his stick figure sliding scales on this to like and figure out what's going on.
It's the world's tiniest political quiz that I demand all four quadrants be represented as the libertarian here who always feels it left out on the, you know, the left right spectrum. But it is a criticism that starts with, what are the politics here? And if the politics don't match up to what I like, that means that this is bad.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's basically it. It is again, it is using fascist as a synonym for thing I don't like, which is annoying in and of itself. But like, I want to take one further step back here and just look at the actual work that Wes Anderson has done over the last few years. I mean, he made The Grand Budapest Hotel, which is like the great anti-fascist film of our time. I mean, it's literally a movie about how Nazism destroys culture and social society and, you know, the finer things in life. It's the way authoritarian and totalitarian regimes break down the little things that make the world work. And it is, again, I think it's like the actual great anti-fascist film that has been made in this era. And then look at Isle of Dogs. Isle of Dogs is a movie about that's literally about how grotesque it is to exterminate undesirables. It is a movie about Holocaust without Holocaust. It's about dogs, and like I guess you could argue, like there is an argument to be made that trivializes the idea of, you know, suffering and oppression.
Moonrise Kingdom is a movie about the impotence of traditional masculinity and specifically men in the like scoutmaster and police roles. You know, I mean, if you're.
It's crazy. It's just a crazy thing. But I have to say I'm somewhat heartened that the response to this is like almost universally just dunking.
Yeah.
It's one of the few times when universal dunking is something to be celebrated because it's such a dumb bad take.
I mean, there's also a role that Twitter is playing here in boosting this
in ways that we wouldn't,
if you think about academics and sort of academic-related people, right, people in that world, have been doing bad politicized film criticism for a long time. But if they did that in 1987, it would get published in like a little monograph that no one would read. And the only way you would hear it about it is if a major critic happened to reference it in their review or do an essay about it. Or if like a conservative provocateur, you know, decided to make an issue out of this really dumb take, you know, this, can you believe what these crazy college professors are saying? But it wouldn't become the sort of thing where like, we're pundits with followings. We're just like discussing this on a, you know, sort of entering popular discourse. Like this was not just being talked about by people who are, film critics. This was being talked about by a bunch of magazine journalists who write about business and economics over the weekend. And that's because Twitter allows the extra bad takes. Like it in some ways it selects for them, right?
Yeah.
Because this was a nuclear bad take and Twitter was like, ooh. We're gonna make sure everyone sees that.
This is a tweet by someone who is auditioning to become Twitter's main character of the day, right?
I mean, yeah. Got jealous of all of Elon's attention.
And in some ways, I actually feel bad about the dunking, even though it's like on the one hand, it's totally appropriate from a, you know, just sort of like a substantive perspective. It's also like this is not the right way to give attention to someone in a lot of ways. And there is, you know, again, it's wrong. And if you're going to talk about movies and talk about how people think about movies, there is, you know, on the one hand, it's like, I think, fair game. Someone put this out there in the public for other people, you know, for other people to see. At the same time, I just like, I also feel like people have bad opinions sometimes and they put them on Twitter. And probably most people should put fewer opinions on Twitter. And like we should
but
all
then
just
what
like
we have to
we
dunk
stop
on?
The pylons.
The only possible ending here is that Wes Anderson will cast Saoirse Ronan to play this failed academic in his ultimate movie about Twitter, and she will be like a moderately sympathetic, if blinkered, figure, and the real world analog will hate it so much.
I want to see this movie, except I think that Wes Anderson's Twitter movie will not be about Twitter, right? Because he always makes the movie about something that's almost the thing, but not quite, right? Isle of Dogs is about the Holocaust, except it's not, right? Like, you know, even Grand Budapest Hotel doesn't. It's not a movie that is like mostly about Nazis, you know, war, right? It's like it's adjacent to that. It's happening at the same time, and you see the dawn of Nazi fascism, but not in a like a really direct, you know, like Steven Spielberg is making a World War II movie kind of sense.
Yeah. So, what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Wes Anderson is a fascoid? Alyssa.
I hate everything. The tweet is controversial. Wes Anderson is not controversial, which in its of itself is a controversial take.
Peter.
I think the word fascioid is a controversy, just the existence of it.
George Orwell is stumbling out of his grave.
The number of times we've used it in the last 15 minutes is a controversy.
Wes Anderson's obvious and horrifying fascism is a huge controversy, and I'm glad somebody finally had the courage to tackle it on Twitter.com. So thank you to our academic friend there. If you enjoy the show, and who doesn't, we're going to have a bonus episode on the subject of meta movies, movies about movies, movies, stories about stories, that sort of thing, over at atma.thebulwark.com. Should go up on Friday. Fingers crossed. I know we delayed the bonus episode going up this week, but we'll get this one up on time, hopefully. That'll be fun. Go check it out. In the meantime, we're going to move on to the main event, which is about a meta movie, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. Starring Nick Cage as the character Nick Cage. The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent is about an actor who has run into financial difficulties. He really wants to get this one last big role, and he's in talks with a director who's played by, interestingly, David Gordon Green. I don't know if you guys realize that. The director is an actual director, fairly well known. He needs to pay off all his bills. He's got to pay off the tax man. He's got to pay off his suite at the Sunset Hotel. And he is given the chance to earn $1 million by going to a birthday party for an international criminal, Javi Gutierrez, played by Pedro Pascal. In the course of doing this, he is intercepted by the CIA, two agents played by Tiffany Haddish and Ike Barinholtz. They want him to figure out if this international criminal has taken hostage a presidential daughter, and he has to save her. Look, here's the thing. We discussed this a little bit offline, and I think we all felt fairly similarly about it. But what's fascinating to me about this movie is that it's basically two movies. There is this meta movie, this movie about movies, this conflict between art and commerce that is personified by Nick Cage, who talks to a version of himself from the Wild at Heart era, and it's done with this horrifying de-aging CGI thing. That is like it is itself, I think, intended as a comment upon what we are seeing in the movies. But there's this whole big meta discussion about what it means to be an actor versus a movie star, what it means to succeed in this business, how somebody can be mad at Nick Cage for working too much. You know, he has a whole riff. He's like, I'm an actor. I like to act. I like to work. I like to be in these roles. And people say I'm working too much. How can you work too much? And then there's a second movie, which is a fairly standard, pretty rote, pretty unremarkable, frankly, subpar action comedy, right? It's a big studio action comedy where Nick Cage is doing big studio action comedy things, and there's a bunch of very obvious jokes, most of which we see in the trailer. I was just bored. I was bored for the whole last, I don't know, hour of this movie, the whole last 70 minutes of this movie, which is unfortunate because the first part of the movie, that first 30 minutes, was a pretty good riff. It reminded me of Adaptation, the movie where Nick Cage plays Charlie Kaufman and Donald Kaufman, who doesn't exist, but the writer of the film Adaptation, Charlie Kaufman, and it's just a riff on like what does it mean to actually work in Hollywood, and you know what does it mean to sell out, what does it mean to become a hack in the studio system, and this movie is just like, you know what, hackdom is okay, being a hack is fine. And I kind of hated it. I kind of hated that part of it. Again, didn't hate the movie, but it is, I think, a betrayal of its most interesting idea. But maybe I'm wrong. Peter, what did you make of The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent?
I might have liked it just a little bit better than you, but not that much better. I think this is a movie that manages to try too hard and not hard enough at the same time. And you talked about this movie as a kind of a meta movie. It's a movie about movies, right? And so he gets to he meets Javi, and Javi is an aspiring screenwriter who wants Nick Cage, the famous actor Nick Cage, fictionalized version of himself, to read his screenplay. And so, in the course of the CIA investigation, he develops a friendship based on Nick Cage's love of movies and the idea of maybe they're going to make a movie together. So they spend a lot of time talking about the kind of movie they want to make. All of their conversations about the kind of movie they want to make are commentaries on the movie you are watching, right? This is a movie that is footnoted itself extensively within the text of the film, because it is always, right, well, we want to make an adult drama, but, you know, not too talky, not just two guys sitting in a room. You know, right? And then it
has to be character driven.
Has to be character driven, but also let's make it, let's give it an action edge, right? And let's not, right? And there's this weird sense in which the movie
has to have a trailer moment.
Apologizing for itself, for its own existence, and saying, you know, look, this isn't a great movie, but like that's sort of like it feels strangely defensive. And it actually reminds me a little bit of a movie we watched maybe a month ago or so, The Lost City, which is another film that's like a very generic, pretty good at best, just sort of basically competent studio action comedy built around two stars who are undeniably appealing. I think actually Bullock and Tatum work better as a pair than Nick Cage and Pedro Pascal here. I think Pedro Pascal is only okay, whereas Nick Cage is very good throughout this movie. But it's a right, it's a two-star film that is just sort of unapologetically leaning into classic, it's not even classic, sort of like Hollywood standards, right? The kinds of movies that all of us have been watching since the 1980s, these big action star-driven adventures. And just saying, we're just going to do that and it's going to be okay, even in the age of everything has to be a superhero film. And the problem is that the second story here, all of the CIA action adventure stuff is awful. And if you're going to make that movie, if you're going to make a movie that's like, the joke is we're doing the thing that you have to do to get your Hollywood movie made, then that second thing should be good, because otherwise you're just giving in to the, like you are making a movie that this, where like, in some ways the Straussian reading of this movie is Hollywood kind of sucks and the movies are bad, right? Like it's in some ways it wants to defend these things, but the thing it gives you that it wants to defend is objectively very, very mediocre and elevated only by the fact that Nicolas Cage is just an incredibly watchable performer. But I didn't, like I said, I didn't care even that much for Pedro Pascal. I thought every other performer besides the two of them was just a total drag on the story and the screen. And I only wanted to get back to watching Nick Cage and his weird CG de-aged alter ego argue with himself. It was the only part of the movie that I thought was actually clever enough to deserve being made.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically how I felt about the movie. I mean, I wrote a fairly long piece about Nicolas Cage a year or so ago titled The Nicolas Cage Paradox. And the paradox is this. He is always worth watching even if the movies he is in are not. And I think that is very much true of this movie. He is fascinating to watch argue with himself. He's fascinating to watch wallow in self-pity. He's fascinating to watch as kind of a hammy guy working on a terrible Boston accent to be in this David Gordon Green movie. And at the same time, everything that does not directly involve him on screen is at best rote and at worst kind of terrible. Alyssa, what did you make?
I agree with everything both of you had said so far, but what I wanted to add is that I thought this is a strangely narrow movie about being Nicolas Cage, right? Because there's stuff that's missing from sort of all the different things that it's doing about his work. You know, for example, like, Javi appears to be the world's biggest Nicolas Cage fan, but only of like a sort of limited slice of Nicolas Cage, right? He comes across as a Nicolas Cage fan who like hasn't seen Leaving Las Vegas or Adaptation. At least that was sort of the subtext to me.
It certainly emphasizes Nicolas Cage's sort of peak 90s leading man action star roles.
Exactly. And part of what's interesting about Nicolas Cage is that he is someone who has both made, you know, Wild at Heart and Leaving Las Vegas and Adaptation and most recently Pig, and has had the huge, you know, sort of 90s action stardom, and then has had the sort of, you know, total schlock aspect to his personality. I don't know if either of you saw Ghost Rider in theaters, but I definitely did, and that movie is insane.
I saw both of them.
Yeah, there's just a lot going on there. And so the movie is kind of missing the full aspect of Nicolas Cage's strangeness as an actor, but then it's also missing the full range of his strangeness as a person, right? I mean, the backstory for the sort of Nicolas Cage's actor is he's like a kind of sad sack divorced guy who, you know, doesn't quite relate to his teenage daughter and is like spending a lot of money living in a hotel instead of a strange guy who's going broke buying dinosaur bones, right? I mean,
And I think a four-time divorcee,
yes,
right? Like at this point in his life, right? Yeah. This is not somebody who is like, the movie gives us a Nicolas Cage who is essentially an upper middle class family man who's relatable. And it doesn't strike me that the real Nicolas Cage actually is that.
No. Not at all. And so it's weirdly anemic as a movie about Nicolas Cage movie star, right? Like it's just sort of, it's generic even in its exploration of someone who is fascinating because he is so strange as a personal individual and as a professional.
And it only barely hints at the real Nicolas Cage's deep, deep love of and knowledge of movies. And if you've ever watched interviews with Cage where they actually let him talk about his theory of acting, he is fascinating because almost all of his performances, like you think he's just like showing up on set and screaming like a wild man and just like going crazy for whatever reason. And I think probably there is some of that going on, especially sort of in his later performances. At the same time, he always has classic movies in mind that he is explicitly basing his performances on. And so many of his performances are built around his favorite silent films and like they are reference heavy and update, right? Like he is a student of the history of cinema and has built that into his performance repertoire, which is why I think some of his antics actually have staying power, is that whatever else he might be, he's a very smart film artist and smart about the way that film works. And he actually thinks really deeply about this stuff, even though it sometimes looks like he's just a guy who shows up and screams and, you know, goes crazy.
Well, and he makes stuff work that shouldn't work, right? I mean, you know, Moonstruck is not a movie that works unless Nicolas Cage gives that specific performance, right? Pig, I think, is not a movie that works unless Nicolas Cage gives that specific performance. And, you know, the movie makes him generic, and it's so depressing.
And it's pleased with itself for doing so.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of what I was getting at when I said that the movie works too hard in some ways. All of these like clever setups and payoffs, you're right. We're back. Not that we were ever gone, like repeated as like this like little mantra throughout the film that like caps certain moments. The bad gangster monologue being dropped in the first act and then pulled up again in act three, like that sort of thing. It's like it's structurally coherent, right? This movie has given us all of the setup and payoff beats that you're supposed to have in a Save the Cat, Robert McKee film. Like it is, it's tightly made in that sense, right? And competent. But none of those beats mean anything, right? Like those beats are supposed to be there not just to remind you that the beginning of the movie happened and that you've been sitting there for 2 hours. They're supposed to be like, oh, now something has changed and I see this in a new light. And not at one point did I ever see anything in a new light in this film.
It's also a waste of Tiffany Haddish, which now that I've seen the performance she's capable of giving in The Card Counter is just something I'm going to be irritated with every time she's not good in a movie again.
But that's what big classic studio movies do, is right? They waste talented performers.
But this, I would not hold out too much hope for her because I do think her like kind of standard mode is annoying and I loved her in The Card Counter. I thought she was great in The Card Counter, but it's the first time I've ever seen her and thought, oh, she's really, really good. Yeah.
This movie also has Ike Barinholtz in it, which for me just like automatically, I am allergic to him. I think he's awful. I wish he was not in this, and every minute he's on screen just like sucks the life out of it for me even further, in so much as there is life to be sucked out of it.
Can we talk a little bit about Pedro Pascal? Because he has an interesting career to me. He's on arguably, you know, one of the biggest show on streaming. Certainly the show that helped turn Disney Plus into a hit. He's the Mandalorian, but we never really see him.
Yep.
He's almost always got the
Mandalorian, and he shows up for like one day a year of shooting when he has to take his helmet off.
No, I think he's there. He's always got that helmet on. You know, okay. That's him mostly. You know, sure.
Look,
sure.
I don't know for certain, but I certainly have encountered rumors that it is mostly not him in that suit.
He was great in the season of Game of Thrones he was on, but he was also like, you know, dies horribly and is not present thereafter.
He is in the Wonder Woman sequel as the bad guy. And
which is
he's totally
awful.
I think you can see him trying in a badly written role.
Yeah.
He's fine, but the movie is bad and his character is bad. in it. I don't know. He's an interesting actor to me because I feel like he has it, right? He has that undefinable star quality. He is attractive. He is a good actor. But, like, he is being put into roles that are not to his benefit in some of these movies.
In a weird way, I feel like the slot that is missing that he would be good in is, like, sort of Harrison Ford adjacent roles, which don't really exist anymore. I mean, part of it is, like, he's a little older. He's got, like, a slightly unusual face, although he's still very, very handsome. He's not huge, you know, in the way that, like, action stars sort of have to be these days. Like, there's something a little bit potentially cerebral about him. And those kind, again, like, the Harrison Ford comparison is not exact, but there's something in that, you know, slightly more intellectual, like, different body frame, still quite sexy lane that just doesn't exist in movies anymore that I think is what he would be really wonderful in.
See, to me, he reads a little more like someone like Bill Paxton, who is this sort of boundary case between a leading man and a character actor who has a little bit of kind of vulnerability to him, but also a little bit of deviousness, is not unattractive, is like an attractive enough guy, but isn't like just conventionally sort of like, you know, Captain America handsome.
As the middle-aged lady on this podcast, I'm going to issue an official ruling that Pedro Pascal is hot.
Okay. I won't argue with that one. But I would in many ways prefer, I think my favorite role of his is Game of Thrones, the one season he was there. And what made that role work was that he wasn't the center of the story. He was an intriguing outsider character. And that's the kind of, that's what I would want to see him in more often. And I felt like, even though I don't dislike him, he just, next to Nicolas Cage, like Nicolas Cage is the freaking sun here. And even if this guy is like a, you know, a Jupiter level planet, like there's just no comparison between the two. And Nicolas Cage just dominated every single scene that they were in. And I only really wanted to see the Nicolas Cage part of it.
Can we talk about a little bit about the movie's idea of actor versus movie star? Because I do think there is, again, an interesting kernel of an idea there. The Nicolas Cage being at war with himself, like, am I an actor? Am I worried about craft? Or am I a movie star? Am I the biggest person in the world? I mean, do you think that they successfully get at the kernel of that idea, Alyssa?
No,
or is
no.
that
again, in part because the actorly part of Cage's work is so missing from the film, right? I mean, you know, it's a mistake to have him be doing that bad Boston accent, in part because it doesn't get at all at the sort of at the quietness that he can bring to a role, at the sort of stillness, but also the combination of that and his more sort of explosive side, which is part of what makes him so fascinating to watch. I don't think they get at that because the movie isn't interested in his actorly qualities at all.
I think it's an interesting idea that the movie introduces and then totally forgets about. And it's a reference, of course, to the way that Nicolas Cage's career has gone, which is that he starred in really big studio tentpoles throughout the 1990s and the early aughts, you know, through the sort of National Treasure years. And then he had some financial difficulties and some other things. And the last decade or so, he has been one of these sort of VOD stars where he's been doing, in some cases, I think as many as 6 movies a year. Certainly he's had 4 or 5 movie years. A lot of stuff that we have not, like I would imagine most, we have not seen most of these movies. I mean, he had at least one other movie besides Pig come out last year that was some crazy post-apocalyptic thing that I didn't see at all, even though I'm sort of vaguely interested in it. And the movie implicitly references this in that opening scene in the hotel room where, you know, he's sort of talking with himself about whether he's, you know, just a professional actor who likes to work or whether he's a movie star who should only be in movie star-like productions. And then it completely forgets that as the rest of the movie unfolds. And so, you know, in some ways, this is a very polished script, like I said, in the sense that it has really defined act structures, right? Even like a joke about the end of the second act and the beginning of the third act, where it like tags it, you know, in the script. And then it also doesn't have a theme, like that sort of like a thematic through line that takes you through this movie where you can see that there is an like a real idea that is being explored and developed. It's just, let's hit these beats at the right minute count, at the right page count in the script so that we can say that we hit them, and let's have opening and closing, you know, sort of tags that remind you that, oh, we've gotten to the end of the movie. This is, you know, you remember that stuff that happened at the beginning? It's all coming together, except it's not coming together. It's coming together into nothing.
Yeah. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent? Alyssa?
Thumbs down.
Peter?
Sadly, thumbs down, though I do think that a certain brand of Nicolas Cage-aholic will appreciate it just enough.
Thumbs down for me as well. And I have to say, I'm fairly surprised that this movie is like 88% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, has either a B+ or an A- from CinemaScore. We are very much in the minority here. So if you like big, lazy studio comedy action movies, this might be the flick for you. Go check it out. All right, that is it for this week's show. If you enjoyed it, please tell a friend. You know, if you don't tell friends, the podcast dies. I can't remember. I read the script literally every week, and I cannot remember how it goes.
Talk to your friends about this podcast. We talk to our friends about movies.
Talk to your friends about this podcast. If you did not enjoy the show, send me a message on Twitter at Sonny Bunch, and I will convince you that it is the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.